Good afternoon, and thank you so much for tuning in to the October edition of Dialogue. I'm your host, Hannah Martin. Today, we're going to explore two facets of mental health in Tennessee. First, the resources available in rural areas, or rather the lack thereof. And later in the program, we're going to look at how mental illness is impacting East Tennessee's homeless population. As we delve into the conversation today, it's important to remember that mental illness doesn't have a type. I spoke with September Sweet of East Knoxville about the misconceptions people have when they realize she lives with mental illness.
My name is September Sweet, and I hail from East Knoxville. I run into the idea that bipolar disorder makes you dangerous, that I'm off the rails, that I could snap at any moment and hurt someone else. I run into the idea that I am crazy, that I am not to be trusted. I run into the idea that people, like in a romantic relationship, this is why you're like this. It's not that we had a conflict. It's that you have a problem, and this is you. It's never me. I run into people who don't think I'm capable at my jobs. I run into people who refuse to accept that you can be well with this illness. And that's the worst thing, next to the fact that when I speak out that, and this, I guess this hurts the most to say, when you speak out, I'm doing it for attention. I'm not doing this for attention. I'm doing this for awareness. I'm giving a platform so that others can be brave. Since I've been open and honest after getting myself diagnosed, I was in a training on mental illness, and it was with a group of peers. And my experiences, when I shared those, everyone else talked about theirs. And over, it was bipolar disorder, bipolar disorder, bipolar disorder. I realized I had bipolar disorder. I went to my own clinician and said, is this me? When we could talk about it as peers, it was different. But when you're talking about it to anyone else, that thing that hurts is that they imagine it's not real. It's not like another illness. It's not like diabetes, where there's a quick fix. In the end, it's me in my head having created this.
With that out there now, I hope that you will feel comfortable to call into the broadcast today and share how mental illness has impacted your life. The number to call is 865-974-5050, or you can connect with us online on Twitter and Facebook at the handle WUOTFM. If you choose to connect with us via Twitter, use the hashtag WUOTDialogue. I'm so glad to have in the broadcast today Dr. Perinda Khatri. She is the Chief Clinical Officer at Cherokee Health Systems. Dr. Khatri, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So Dr. Khatri, to start off this conversation, one of the things that I want our listeners to understand is the scope of mental illness in Tennessee. In your work, have you identified a particular age group suffering from mental illness more so than others?
Well, we are seeing it across all age groups. I think the themes that are new for us are seeing, number one, the increased rates of substance misuse, substance use disorders in the elderly. So people who really never had a history of substance use disorders over age 65 are now experiencing problems with addiction. We're also seeing in younger kids the exposure to trauma from even birth or the prenatal period really seems to be impacting their overall adjustment.
You mentioned that there are disorders that are evolving later in life and that trauma plays a big role in mental illness. Outside of those items, is there a particular diagnosis that you find you're giving out most often? Do people suffer with anxiety? Is it depression? Is it bipolar disorder? Or is it really the culmination of life events that then leads to this emergence later on?
Well, I think all of those are true. And one of the things we've realized is that, you know, these experiences happen on a continuum. And so absolutely having adverse childhood experiences, we know, can result in a multitude of health problems, not just mental health, but also physical health, and can in fact impact mortality and morbidity. Probably the most common symptom presentation that we see, and actually this is the most common across the world, is depression. But having depression is not the same for everyone. And so for many people, they may have depression and anxiety. They may also have a substance misuse component to it. But we're recognizing more and more that this is all manifestation of one type of mental suffering or pain or another.
As we discuss the scope of this mental illness, one of the things that we mentioned earlier in the broadcast is that therapy deserts exist, especially in rural areas of Tennessee. Can you explain for us what exactly a therapy desert is?
Well, a therapy desert is where you have a geographic location in which mental health treatment services are not available. And not only are they not available, they're not accessible. So even if someone has a mental health center in their county, they may be, for example, in East Tennessee, they may be living in a mountain. They may be living a two-hour drive away from the closest mental health treatment center. So we don't have enough mental health treatment options, but also it's very hard to get to, particularly in rural areas. So transportation and just sheer work shortage of treatment options constitute a mental health treatment desert.
So transportation, I'm so glad that you're illuminating this for us, because that's something that I think, even as I thought about this, I wouldn't have considered a barrier to resources. Is that what you'd consider to be the biggest barrier, the transportation, the ability to get there, or is it lack of funding upon arrival that presents a greater problem?
Well, certainly transportation is a significant problem in rural areas. And again, people may have to drive hours and hours just to get to the closest treatment facility, and that gas for them is expensive, or they may not even have access to a car that will go that far. There are very few treatment options for people who don't have insurance or resources. Certainly, organizations like us, Cherokee Health Systems, we're an integrated primary care and behavioral health organization. We offer care to anyone regardless of ability to pay, but treatment providers like us are too far and not enough of us. So really, lack of available resources for people who don't have insurance plays an important role. I will say, however, even people who have insurance, even people who have plenty of financial resources, struggle to find the kind of mental health service treatment that they need.
Yeah, and that's something that came up a lot in research as well, that folks who are able to pay, it's just a struggle to get that coordinated care and go through all the steps necessary to truly work through whatever issue is plaguing them. So, you know, before I get into your work with Cherokee Health Systems, what other resources do you think are missing for folks? What piece of mental health treatment is lacking, especially the further out we go?
Well, the most challenging part in our work is trying to find treatment for substance use disorders and addiction. We don't have enough of those treatment centers, treatment providers, and the need across the board, but particularly in rural areas, is tremendous. So it is not uncommon for someone from East Tennessee to have to go out of state or across the state to find a treatment for substance use disorders, particularly in detox and the early stages of getting treatment for addiction.
As we're discussing these different resources that are available to folks, I'd like to go ahead and take a call. We have a call from Crab Orchard. Welcome to the broadcast. What's your question?
Yes, ma'am. I am on Social Security. I have Medicare Advantage, Blue Cross Blue Shield. I can't find anyone that takes that. And even if they did, the copay is prohibitive when you're on a limited income. And I suffer from serious depression. I had just started this. And it's sad that there's not more places for people to go. And then the medication on top of that. I fall in a bad category of I have insurance, so I can't do the sliding scale programs, but yet I don't find anybody that takes my insurance, and the copays are prohibitive.
Thank you for the call. Dr. Khatri, I'm going to let you respond to that. What's your response to the plight of these folks who say, I really need the help and I just can't seem to get it?
Well, I think, you know, unfortunately, cases like this are far too common, that we have people who are suffering tremendously. And even though they have coverage, it's not adequate coverage, and we don't have enough providers. So this is really an area for advocacy at the state level, at the federal level, because we really do need to have, I think, a major shift in how we are paying for health care, providing access to health care, because just having a health insurance card does not guarantee anything. And just like the caller said, accessing appropriate level of care is challenging at every level, but certainly when you feel like you can't even pay for one or both components of care, whether it's therapy, medication, transportation to the site, one of the things I often will ask people to do is to call their insurance company, call the number on the card, and talk with them about the need for more services and more resources that will fit what their current abilities are. Because insurance companies really are required to contract with enough providers in enough areas to be able to provide access to care, to be able to make it easier for people to pay for care. And so unfortunately, people really have to take on the role of advocate for self and talk with your insurance company, give that message consistently, and hopefully enough people will be communicating the same message that we can really move and advocate for change.
I'm glad that you mentioned the importance of speaking with your insurance provider and with your care providers, because although it was in a different setting, even for me, moving down to Tennessee and being here for the first time, I had to do some juggling with, you know, what can I get covered? What resources are available for my own needs? And picking up that phone and making that call and talking with the resources on the other end of the line really does, at least in my experience, take some of the complexity out of setting up whatever care you need. I now want to go to a call on the line from Maryville. Thank you so much for calling Dialogue. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much. Just wanted to thank the person who sounds like they're in studio for talking about their experiences. So thank you. I know it can be tough because you don't want people to make that your only identifier. You can't go up to somebody and say, hey, I'm so-and-so, and I have depression. It's like something out of a Tignataro stand-up. But as a 36-year-old male with depression and eating disorders, you know, I've had to go out of state three different times for inpatient care. And even now, I have a United Healthcare plan that has been extremely helpful. They seem to really go out of their way to search for things, but the options in this area, even a place like Maryville, are very limited. In fact, my therapist has been covered under insurance for several years. She is no longer going to be covering or accepting my insurance as part of my care, and it's a weird situation. It's a weird situation because a lot of people don't even look at it as something, you know. They say, oh, it's in your head. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And for a guy, you know, even more so, the dynamic is slightly different, you know, than that of, you know, females, you know, especially females with eating disorders versus guys with eating disorders. Some of the things are similar, but a lot is very different. But again, I just want to thank you guys. Cherokee, I've used you guys in the past, and you've been very helpful. So I just want to thank you for talking about this and everything that you guys have done. So anyway,
thank you so much for calling in. We know that this is not an easy conversation to have, much less on a radio show. So to those of you who take the time to participate in the conversation today, I commend you. And it just reminds us that, as I mentioned earlier in the program, mental illness has no type. These experiences are not the same for all people. And that is why having this conversation with folks like Dr. Parinda Khatri is so important. She is my guest for the first segment of this show. She is a chief clinical officer at Cherokee Health Systems. We're going to take a short break really quickly, and then we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm your host, Hannah Martin, and if you're just tuning in, we're talking about mental health in Tennessee today. My guest on the line is Dr. Perinda Khatri. She is the Chief Clinical Officer at Cherokee Health Systems, and people have called in today and started to share their experiences with mental health. I encourage you to do the same. The number is 865-974-5050. You're also welcome to connect with us on our social media platforms, Twitter and Facebook, using the handle WUOTFM. If you want to communicate on Twitter, I ask that you also use the hashtag WUOTDialogue. Dr. Khatri, I know I have to let you go in a few minutes here, but before we say goodbye to you, I have a couple of questions, in part stemming from the last call that we just received, as this man was describing how in his introducing himself to folks, there's difficulty in trying to say, this is what I struggle with, look at me as a person and not the illness or the demons, if you will, that accompany my everyday. In your line of work, as you care for folks who are dealing with struggles in mental illness, is there certain language that you try to avoid or be mindful of when treating folks so that you take maybe the sting or the weight out of a diagnosis or conversation about mental health?
Well, certainly stigma, perceived or actual within our communities and even with our friends and family, presents a very challenging and emotionally painful situation because people do feel judged and actually may be judged. One of the things that we help people do is understand and recognize that whatever experiences they're having, that may explain part of who they are, but it does not define them. And so when people will use terms like, I'm schizophrenic, or I'm a depressed person, automatically you are using that experience to define who you are. And so I challenge people and to say, you are more than just this one diagnosis. Just like someone who may have diabetes should not say, I'm diabetic and that's all I am, because someone with depression or an eating disorder or bipolar disorder also has other parts of who they are. Foods that they like, hobbies maybe that they used to enjoy, preferences in terms of art, are they introverted, extroverted? So I encourage people to think more about this as being part of their experience, but not their entire definition of who they are.
I think that is so powerful. And actually, to that point, in my conversation with September Sweet, one of the things that she told me was that when we were engaging in conversation, I kept saying, folks were struggling with mental illness. And she made this, what I thought was a very eloquent point about, I'm living with mental illness, not struggling with it. And in her clip that we played earlier in the broadcast, she makes note of the fact that people have to understand you can be well, although you may have some sort of mental plight. You can still be a well person, and it is so true that a diagnosis does not define an individual. I know that you practice a model of integrated care. Before we let you go, can you explain what that is and why you support that style of care when treating folks with mental illness?
Well, one of our goals is really to improve access and quality of care, both in rural, urban areas. And what we found is people tend to go to primary care first when they are addressing kind of the multitude of health issues. And because so many people feel comfortable going to primary care, in fact, most people get their mental health concerns addressed in the primary care setting. So we blend in behavioral health expertise into primary care so we can not only provide access to care at the point of the primary care visit, we are also able to collaborate and communicate and coordinate with the entire team. One of the challenges that we hear from people is the level of fragmentation. They may see three or four providers, none of whom are communicating, none of whom know what the other is doing, and the onus then becomes on the patient to try to pull these pieces together.
Right.
We really try to emphasize a team-based model in which we blend in the expertise that people need and can provide access to mental health services, but in general, this level of coordination, because these issues, depression, anxiety, substance use problems, they typically don't occur in isolation of physical health problems. It's not unlikely for us to have people who are managing other chronic health conditions, and they all interact. So our goal is really to optimize the quality of care and provide access to care. So sometimes we'll say, you know, listen, there is such a thing as a neck. We are connecting the head and the body.
Yes.
And we want to, you come to us as a whole person. We want to work and partner with you on your health as a whole person.
Well, Dr. Khatri, again, she is the Chief Clinical Officer at Cherokee Health Systems. I thank you so much for joining the broadcast today and lending your expertise to this conversation. Something that I'm taking away from our discussion is, again, the importance of communication, whether you're the patient or you're the provider. Communication and dealing with mental health is so, so vitally important. Thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to switch gears now, and we're going to focus on how mental illness impacts Tennessee's homeless population. I'm thrilled to have in studio with me Dr. David Patterson. He is the Cooper Heron Endowed Professor of Mental Health Research and Practice in the University of Tennessee College of Social Work and the founding director of the Knoxville Homeless Management Information System. Dr. Patterson, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you for the invitation.
So let's start off with the fact that Dr. Khatri pointed this out in our earlier segment. Mental illness rarely stands alone. I know that's something that you've seen in your work. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I really appreciated her point on that, that mental illness, especially among homeless individuals, is not simply just mental illness, that being homeless can both be the result of a psychological difficulties and also can be exacerbated or made much worse by being homeless. And because you're essentially trying to survive on the streets or in shelters. And oftentimes, along with that, our data suggests that there is substance use and substance abuse, which in some ways makes sense, that if you are living in a dangerous, volatile, uncertain environment, that the use, and not to advocate for it, but the use of substances oftentimes makes sense.
Self-medicating.
And then along with that, one is exposed to a wide variety of pathogens and dangerous situations. So you have this combination of psychiatric challenges or emotional challenges, substance use and abuse, and physical difficulties. And so it's a very complex picture.
We actually have a call on the line from Oak Ridge with someone who has difficulties going about their every day dealing with mental illness. Thank you so much for calling Dialogue. You're on the air.
Hey, I just want to say I'm one of the lucky people who has a mental diagnosis. There are a lot of disorders. I don't understand most of them, and the one that I have, as you've described earlier, affects my life, but I'm one of the lucky ones because I have treatment. I have medical treatment. I've got a strong family support system, a lot of things that homeless folks don't have. But I just wanted to say, on the subject of trying to understand why in the world do people with mental challenges not just snap out of it and deal with it. My experience with mood disorders is like owning a car where you step on the gas and about half the time the car goes faster, but the other half the time the car suddenly skids to a halt. And likewise, if you step on the brakes, about half the time the car stops or slows down, about half the time the car suddenly speeds up. And I'm talking about moods that just simply don't fit the situation. Now, imagine how that affects your work life. You're trying to hold down a job. You get angry when most people would be happy. You get happy when most people would be angry. And so it brings in the issue of, well, how do you hold a job when the people around you just can't predict what you're going to do next? And I'm not talking about extreme things. I'm talking about little things. But it then becomes understandable why you might drink, you might use drugs if you think they're putting you on more of an even keel. But we all know the terrible side effects of drinking and drugs, you know, probably are worse than the problem you're trying to address. But what other choices do you have if you don't have a strong medical support network and you don't have a strong family network? So my heart goes out to everybody who's got any medical diagnosis, particularly to ones who have a mental health diagnosis. And I would just say, you know, the real challenge in all those cases is just trying to put yourself in the other person's position and see what you need to do to be supportive of them.
Thank you so very much for the call today. That was a wonderful message. Dr. Patterson, before we delve into your experience and your line of work with dealing with homeless individuals who suffer from mental illness and some of the statistics around that, one thing I'd like to do is go ahead and clarify for our listeners the difference in the Knoxville Homeless Management Information System and then the Knoxville-Knox County Homeless Coalition Study, because I know that we're going to pull pieces of research, or data rather, from that research. But can you explain how those two things are different?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Kenna.
I'm glad too.
So the Knox HMIS, or the Homeless Management Information System, is sort of the empirical window into homelessness in our community. And we are a community outreach research extension of the University of Tennessee and the land-grant mission of the University of Tennessee. We work in conjunction with the City of Knoxville's Office on Homelessness. We work in conjunction with the Knoxville, Knox County Homeless Coalition. And so, and for readers, or not readers, but listeners who are interested, they can find the most recently released biennial study on homelessness on our website, knoxhmis.org, and click on reports and you'll see it at the top. So, and what we have done there is we have released both the biennial study, which is a study, a survey of convenience, an in-depth survey of convenience hosted by or put on by the Knoxville Coalition to End Homelessness. And that is, they interviewed about 250 homeless individuals over a 2 or 3 day period. And so you'll find the study there. And that really offers, like I said, it's a survey of convenience, so there's variability, and you see some differences in terms of the facts that come out from the subpopulation that's was surveyed there versus Knox HMIS, which collects data from all the homeless service providers in the community, and that's over 22 homeless service providers on a continual basis. And then we report annually to the community. We have a community dashboard that we update quarterly, and then we report back to agencies, to Knox County, the City of Knoxville, and the federal government.
Okay. As I was looking around actually through that information, one of the things that struck me is that you have this element, and again, this is on the Knoxville Homeless Management Information System, where people who have worked with the management system self-report causes of homelessness. And one of the things that I took away is that so many people listed mental illness as the top reason for their being homeless. And that struck me in that in this conversation that is so difficult to have, this ownership piece, if you are somebody who is living with a mental illness or it's impacted your life, that these folks are willing to say, yes, this absolutely drove me to this place. Do you find in your work that those who are homeless are more willing to talk about the struggles that they've endured, whether it be mental illness or addiction or any other plight they face?
Yeah, my sense is that individuals experiencing homelessness are often both very vulnerable and very open, mm-hmm. that they are vulnerable having lived on the streets and endured life on the streets for however long they've been there, and vulnerable in the sense that oftentimes they've found themselves on the streets because of poverty, lack of employment, high housing prices, or difficulty in finding affordable housing. So they're vulnerable, and at the same time, they're willing to share their lives, to share their understanding of what brought them to this point in their life. And oftentimes, I think it's important to understand that homelessness is in some ways the manifestation of everything that's not working in our society in terms of cost of poverty, trauma, mental health, and lack of available mental health and substance abuse treatment resources, and affordable housing.
As you look at this work and you pull this research, are you seeing a particular demographic suffering more so than others? You know, is it men of a certain age? Is it women of a certain age who are dealing with a mental illness and grappling with housing or job stability? Is it prevalent in one group versus another?
I don't think I can separate that out. I think there are two important facts that I would point to. The first is that single female-headed households, the research suggests that oftentimes women who are head of households who are end up homeless oftentimes because of both poverty, the exigencies of life, and the uncertainties of relationships, of domestic violence, and other things. But they also have ended up homeless, that they have associated untreated trauma, and that there's very good research that indicates or suggests that that untreated trauma, that mental health issue, makes it difficult for them to both find housing and sustain housing because of that. We can think about it as the unfinished business of,
right,
of that trauma. The second group that I think, if you look at the demographic information in the Knoxville, the Knox HMIS annual report, is the largest, the peak of the age group are men 40 to 60.
Okay.
And those are, many of them are men who have long histories of substance abuse difficulty, in perhaps inadequate education or insufficient education, but also have poverty of relationships. And, you know, a big part of mental health is good interpersonal relationships. And poverty of relationship and social network is common among the homeless.
That was answering my next question for you, which would be, you know, in your estimation, aside from the fact that clearly those living on the street, or in shelters for that matter, they don't have the financial resources to gain support per se. And so that too, that connectivity piece, I think is something that translates to a broader range of folks who are struggling as well. That is so important to have that social network where you can have these discussions, where you can say, I need support in X, Y, and Z ways. That's important no matter your housing situation, no matter your job situation. I posed this question to Dr. Cottry earlier, and I'm so glad you mentioned the trauma piece, because she mentioned that as well, how that can manifest, especially in older adults. She sees it sort of emerge and create, I believe she said, substance misuse disorders. But one of the things I asked Dr. Cottry, and I'm wondering what your experience is like in on this side of things, terminology around mental wellness, mental health, and mental illness. Do you find that you have to be any more careful than you would with an individual who maybe is of a more stable economic situation, if you will, in terms of how you discuss these challenges, in terms of how you suggest that someone gets help? Do you have to be mindful of any words in particular or phrasing so as not to create, I guess, a sense of shame or fear?
Well, I thought Dr. Khatri's point was extremely well made. And I think that one of the ways of framing it, or one of the ways of answering your question, is that I think we need to all try to avoid seeing people as diagnostic labels. I mean, whether the embracing of substance use by wrapping yourself in the cloak, the identity of I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, and or because as she suggested, that is only a part. A mental health diagnosis is only a part of one's identity. A substance abuse problem is only a part of one's identity. And so I think all of us need to be very mindful and very conscious of not seeing individuals and family members and people on the street through the lens of diagnosis or the lens of pathology, but recognizing that people on the street are there for a multiplicity of factors.
Yes.
There are many paths into homelessness, and what we're looking for are many paths out of homelessness.
If you're listening and are just tuning in, my guest is Dr. David Patterson. He is the Cooper Herron Endowed Professor of Mental Health Research and Practice in the University of Tennessee College of Social Work. He's also the founding director of the Knoxville Homeless Management Information System. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with more dialogue. Welcome back to the October edition of Dialogue. I'm your host today, Hannah Martin. We're talking about mental illness in Tennessee. My guest is Dr. David Patterson. He is the Cooper Herron Endowed Professor of Mental Health Research and Practice in the University of Tennessee College of Social Work. He's also the founding director of the Knoxville Homeless Management Information System. When we left off, Dr. Patterson, we were discussing the importance, and or rather reiterating the point that we mentioned earlier in the program, of separating folks from their diagnosis and identifying them as whole people who have just a little something else going on the side, and keeping in mind, too, that when we apply conversation about mental illness and the homeless, it's important to remember that when you think of folks who are homeless, it may not be mental illness solely that got them there, and it may be something that emerged only once they were without a roof over their heads. One of the things I noticed in the Knoxville-Knox County Homeless Coalition study, which again is different from Dr. Patterson's work with the Knoxville Homeless Management Information System, is that 44% of persons discharged from psychiatric hospitalization went directly to the streets or shelters from those facilities. In your estimation, if you feel comfortable speaking to this, what's leading to that return to the streets? What is it that's not allowing folks to say, okay, I've got my footing, and I'm going to, trying to think of a good way to put it, I've got my feet underneath me, and now I'm ready to just give my life a second shot?
That's a great question. I don't think it's an individual choice. It's a lack of available options in terms of where to discharge people to. That you've seen over the years a decrease in funding and support for mental health services, both for Helen Ross McNabb and also for Cherokee, both of which do wonderful jobs in this community. But there are not transition houses. There are not halfway houses for people coming out of hospitalization, nor are there transition facilities for people being discharged from jail. The homeless who are mentally ill also end up in jail and are commonly discharged back to the street or to shelters. And we, you know, I think that Dr. Cotry made an important point in terms of we really need greater advocacy for resources within this community, not only for transitional housing, but the real solution to homelessness is permanent supportive housing. There's just wonderful, extensive research that if you help people, especially people with emotional difficulties, people with substance abuse or the combination, those co-occurring disorders or disability, if you help them, if you put them into permanent supportive housing, one, you see a decrease in the use and abuse of substances, but you also see that there is a reduction in cost to communities.
On that note of support, we actually have a call from Oak Ridge, somebody who'd like to speak to our earlier point about social isolation. So with that being said, thank you so much for calling Dialogue. You're on the air.
All right. Thanks so much for having me. This Bruce Marshall, and I really appreciate Dr. Patterson's comment about the poverty of social relationships that create some of these issues. And I know the as Dr. Patterson's aware, the American Academy of Social Work has named the eradication of social isolation as one of its grand challenges for the future. And I found it fascinating that a fairly recent study has shown that the health risk of social isolation is on par with things like smoking, diabetes, and obesity, which I found shocking when I first saw it. And I'd be interested in Dr. Patterson's comments on that. And I know I'm a social worker with Contact Caroline, and that's really where our work is centered, is on those kind of issues.
Well, thank you so much for the call. I will give Dr. Patterson the floor.
Well, thank you for your call, and thank you for the question. I appreciate you pointing to the issue of social isolation and the recognition that that's one of the grand challenges that social work as a profession is addressing. And while that is not my area of scholarship, I think that broadly, we find this atomization in society, where people are increasingly focused on their screens. There was a study that came out several years ago, Bowling Alone, and about the decline of bowling teams and people engaging in social interaction. And I think that as communities, as faith groups, as companies and organizations, it's incumbent upon us to find ways to increase our connection with each other, to find ways of supporting each other, of being with each other, of putting down the screens from time to time, and to simply be in the presence of others and be present with them.
Let's go to line two from Sharp's Chapel. Thank you so much for calling Dialogue. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to appreciate you guys for letting me talk a little bit, too. I really appreciate you guys shedding a lot of light on this subject, because I am a home visitor that really tries hard to make sure that these adverse childhood interactions don't happen whenever kids are really young, by going in and educating a lot of adults who take care of children to kind of minimize trauma early on, so that you don't have these really hard health outcomes later, along with the mental health aspect too. So I really liked how you guys are talking about social isolation, because most of the families that I go and see, it is headed by single mothers with infants or very young children. And the social isolation that you have in there it's just kind of like, it's an incubator for having mental health issues that exacerbated. So, connecting with each other and making sure that you are actually having resources is a must for what we are talking about now.
Well, thank you so much for the call today. I appreciate it. I'm sure so does Dr. Patterson. We love listening to those folks who are calling in and sharing experiences about how mental health or mental illness has impacted their lives, whether that be your line of work, your own personal battle, whatever it is. We are so glad that you are speaking up. Dr. Patterson, I do have a question for you. As you look in your research and you continue to work on this, do you find, and back to your point about folks who are homeless being vulnerable and being open with their struggles, do you find or do you think that moving forward there will be an increase, at least here in Tennessee, of folks willing to seek out mental treatment? Do you feel like most folks are open, or do you think that we're taking steps back where, whether it's due to lack of resources or simply discomfort, people are less inclined to reach out for help?
Another good question. I think the two things are happening simultaneously. One is that I think that there is, across society, a de-stigmatization that it's no longer stigmatized to have a substance abuse or a mental health challenge or issue. So I think that I think that broadly speaking, people are much more willing to sort of own their challenges, and that's extremely valuable, because it helps bring people in alignment with the truth of their existence, as opposed to pushing aside or denying or in some way attenuating or minimizing difficulty and struggle. The other side of that coin, and as one of your callers alluded to earlier, is the difficulty of simply finding available treatment.
Right.
In terms of, we have a rather fragmented system in terms of their mental health systems, but they serve a certain group of people. There are people with insurance, but not all providers take insurance. Some providers are for fee only. So it's an ongoing challenge as a society and as a community for us to make available more resources to address the sort of growing recognition of both substance abuse and mental health issues.
I'm not sure if you heard the clip earlier in the broadcast from September Sweet. She was sharing the misconceptions that she runs into when folks realize that she's living with mental illness. And one of the things that she mentioned was running into this moment where once people pick up on this ownership piece and they say, this is part of who I am, this is part of what I deal with, although it does not define me, one of the reactions she's met with is, well, you're doing this for attention. Is that something that you've run into in working with the homeless population where mental illness or mental health can be sort of a crutch for resources, or that's somehow maybe the part of the conversation that starts a larger conversation about all of the things that you've mentioned that might accompany mental illness, whether it's childhood trauma or some other financial struggle or imprisonment? Is the attention piece something that you see in that community where folks react to it that way, where it's like, this isn't genuine, this is somebody just asking me to pay extra attention? Because I do think that that exists, interestingly enough, for people who have greater resources, you know, sort of like the prevalence on social media of folks saying, I deal with this. It's a 50-50. Either people say, I'm so glad you're speaking up, I'm here to help, I'm here to relate to you. And then on the other hand, it's, well, you know, you're probably just making that up.
I don't know that I can directly answer that question. So
it was a complicated one, so that's okay.
What I would say is that it's really important for folks to go ahead and live their lives and to recognize that some people will, for whatever reason, push back against or demean people taking ownership of their truth, of their experiences, and that some people, for whatever reason, are uncomfortable or dismissive, and I don't know that we can directly change that, but just simply owning one's life and one's experience, regardless of the reaction, is I think one of the important steps in terms of developing better mental health.
We've talked about the importance of advocacy, the importance of social support, the importance of access to resources, and all of these things are so important in continuing this conversation about mental health. As we've said, if there's one other final piece that you think this is really missing from the conversation when we talk about this, whether it's in Tennessee or outside of our own state, this is something that we're not talking enough about when it comes to mental illness. Is there anything that sticks out in your mind?
I think that, yes. I think that oftentimes it's not appreciated in the broader community that treatment works, that treatment, that we have a wide spectrum of both interpersonal treatments, cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and medications that work. And I think it's important for people who are experiencing both substance abuse and mental health issues to know that there are available, efficacious interventions in the community and in the professions that are providing mental health services.
Dr. David Patterson is the Cooper Heron Endowed Professor of Mental Health Research and Practice in the University of Tennessee College of Social Work and the founding director of the Knoxville Homeless Management Information System. Dr. Patterson, thank you for your time today, and thank you for lending your expertise to the conversation.
Thank you.
Coming up next on 91.9 FM, it's the afternoon concert. Thanks for joining us for the October edition of Dialogue. You can find this show and past episodes on our website at WUOT.org. That'll be up later today. Our show is produced by Greg Hill. Thank you, sir. The November edition of Dialogue will be hosted by Victor Greta. Thanks to all of you who participated in today's program.